This podcast is brought to you by our Supreme Boiler of Leather, Morgan. If you want to find out how to become a Supreme Boiler of Leather or how to get access to the exclusive Patreon content, check out patreon.com/boiledleatherAudioHour. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is Stefan Sasse, and I am with my co-host of today.
Hello.
Hi. Who are you, sir? You stranger, mysterious man that you are.
Oh, do you want me to tell the people who I am? Is that what...
Oh, yes. That would be great. You could say what you are doing and what brought you here. Maybe even tell us your connection to A Song of Ice and Fire. Where did you pick it up? All that beautiful biographical stuff.
Wonderful. Okay.
Posterity awaits.
My name is Clint. I am the author of a blog called Laws of Ice and Fire, which is based on the Song of Ice and Fire series that is the subject of this podcast. I'm also a lawyer in my day job in the United States. I do civil law, civil litigation. And I run, you can find me on Twitter at Westeros Law, or at my personal account at Clint W. And I'm thrilled to be here today.
And I'm thrilled having you. True story, I have invited you like 2 months ago or something, but I was beaten by the Nodacast by a few days, so you had to go to them first, and we had to have this little honorary pause in between, or else I would have had you on sooner. So I'm really excited to talk about all this stuff, because I think this connection that you make up is very unique in fandom. You know, it's like when you want to talk about medieval politics, you go to Stephen Atwell, for example, and if you want to talk about medieval law, basically, that's you now. You made a niche for yourself.
I was just going to say that, you know, I talked to Jeff and Emmett, and I was like, man, Stefan wants to have me on Boiled Leather. What can you do for me? And then they paid me a bunch of money. So that's why the order happened the way it was. They outbid you.
That sounds realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't match this gigantic amount of money that they were offering. Like, it was in the millions, basically. And I thought about making a better offer, including stock options, but then they were just more powerful in that regard, more leverage.
Yes, you know, American capitalism wins every time.
Yeah, it does. It's because the many employees that I have, they are all sitting on these worker council boards, and they're just leeching off the proceeds that I make. So that is the problem in a nutshell. But let's get serious. We want to talk about the Laws of Ice and Fire today, which means in a more broader sense, not tied down to a special book or anything, but rather how do we characterize the law, basically, in A Song of Ice and Fire. And I thought I would start with a softball question, you know, just to get things started. Is there the rule of law in Westeros? You know, a short question can be easily answered in a sentence or less. So do we have a rule of law? What is your take?
Wow. I think that is an extraordinarily broad, but softball question. Sure. I think the answer is generally no. That's the best answer, but, a more complete answer, you really have to go back to, you know, the histories. So when I first started the blog Laws of Ice and Fire, the idea was I was going to go through and categorize all of the laws that were mentioned anywhere in the books or any of the histories. And so I started doing that, and I ended up with a 100-page outline of every time the word law was mentioned in any of the books. And I put them into, you know, general categories. And one of the longest sections in my outline is this section on sort of sovereignty, and who is making the law. And I think the tough part about answering this question is, like, it's tough to pin down a point in history as to when there might have been rule of law at all. The closest that you come, really, in my view, is in Jaehaerys's reign. So before the Targaryen conquest, you had all of these different fiefdoms, these many different kingdoms. This happened, throughout Westeros. There was, the Hundred Kings, and then there was the Seven Kingdoms and whatnot. And maybe within those kingdoms, you might have something approaching rule of law. So rule of law, for folks who, maybe haven't taken a political philosophy class or a class on legal philosophy, rule of law just means that there is a law that everyone follows, including the king. Or including the sovereign, really. So it's not that complex a concept, but when you actually apply it to real world, it becomes really, really dicey. So let's say there was, maybe a king of the Stormlands or the Reach who was created a system of law and like rigidly enforced it even against, allowing himself to be subject to the law. I didn't find any evidence of that, but it's possible. Then you had the Targaryen conquest and you had Aegon, forging the Seven Kingdoms into Westeros. And if you go to the World of Ice and Fire, the book, it actually shows that one of Jaehaerys the First, one of his major initiatives was to actually create a rule of law system. He did his best, kind of, but him and Septon Barth sat down, and it's in the World of Ice and Fire, the Targaryen Kings. There's a quote that says, "With Barth's aid and advice, King Jaehaerys did more to reform the realm than any other king who lived before or after. Where his grandsire, King Aegon, had left the laws of the Seven Kingdoms to the vagaries of local tradition and custom, Jaehaerys created the first unified code so that from the north to the Dornish Marches, the realm shared a single rule of law." And that's basically the idea. So Jaehaerys is like the George Washington of Westeros, and Septon Barth is his James Madison writing down whatever the laws are. And so he took like the vast continent of disparate peoples and laws and unifying them under a common code. That's a monumental achievement. That's a big deal. The problem, of course, is that then you get successive kings who find laws inconvenient. Aegon the Fourth is a great example. And then after Robert's Rebellion, then you have a breakdown in the idea of sovereignty. So then after Robert dies, the whole rest of the series is about all of these various people trying to create other sovereigns. There's not an agreement as to who is the one sovereign. And without that agreement, practically, you're never going to have rule of law. So that's a very long answer to a very short question. But it's a really complex and interesting discussion that one can have about what it really means to have rule of law in Westeros or in the real world.
So let me try to explain where I'm coming from here, basically, when I look at this issue. The rule of law, in a sense of there is a codified book, basically, where we have everything, like Jaehaerys tried to get it, the Justinian code, basically, that we have here. I think that's the historic model that we're going off, right? There's Roman Emperor Justinian who collected all the laws of the Roman Empire into one codex that has been in effect until like 1900 or something. So this is the most familiar to me, where I can feel at home, which I can instinctively understand because it matches up with my liberal background, and liberal here not in a political party sense, but rather as a, general democracy republic kind of thing. And I feel that a law system that is based on tradition and on precedent, and especially on the whims of the lords, that is alien to me, fundamentally so. And I'm currently in the process of rereading Fire and Blood, actually, and I'm just arrived at the section you just basically quoted from the World of Ice and Fire, which is the collection of laws from Barth, and then you have this whole thing going on where they are trying to curtail several prerogatives of the lords, like the right of the first knight and all that stuff. And how is this a general idea that a lord is basically the giver of laws on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's also the superior judge. So in theory, you would expect as a lord that you can make decisions about anything regarding law by yourself. But in reality, people are constrained by all this tradition stuff, you know, precedent. People are saying, yeah, but your grandfather did it otherwise. And then in some way, you have to adhere to that in practice, but not really in theory. So how does this interplay work, you know? Is this basically a kind of social pressure situation in which a lord has to maneuver the expectations of society at large, and mostly of his peers and even superiors? Or how does this work when you do not have codified, written down laws?
The answer is it doesn't. I think the sort of liberal, and in the way that you say it, philosophical tradition would say that it's impossible. If you look at Montesquieu, who wrote in The Spirit of Laws in the 1500s, I think it was, that essentially you can't have a government that doesn't have separation of powers, a functioning government that doesn't have separation of powers. And you hit on a really big problem. So if the lord or the king or whoever it is the one who's writing the laws and enforcing the laws at the same time, it's going to be impossible for that lord to effectively effectuate all of the laws. It is antithetical to human nature to be able to do both things. And that's why he argued for a rigid separation of powers. And most countries since the 1500s, most countries since the American Revolution that have created governments since then have made efforts at separating powers in some way. I did some research on the government of Germany because I wasn't as familiar with it, but the government of Germany has separation of powers. You have a legislature, and then you have an executive and a judicial branch. The American government does too. Westerosi government doesn't have separation of powers. And you see how problematic that is throughout the history of Westeros. You see it with Aegon IV, you know, declaring certain laws that that he finds inconvenient. He just declares them a nullity. You see it with Cersei, you know, going back on this tradition of having a sort of demilitarized faith, just so that she can, you know, sort of have a power play against the Tyrells. It's an inherent problem in human nature to try and create a government where there isn't one, a codified structure of law, and two, the separation of powers. The World's Justice Project, which is a nonprofit organization, they have like four requirements for rule of law, and one of them is that the laws themselves are just. And obviously, you can make an argument one way or the other with regard to most Westerosi laws as to whether or not they're just. That another requirement is that there's an accessible and impartial dispute resolution. And I think Westeros actually does kind of have that. Whether it's impartial is probably wrong, but it has a dispute resolution, and we can talk a little bit more about that later. But it doesn't have the other two factors, which is open government, meaning like, you know, people see what's going on, or accountability, meaning, you know, if a king makes the wrong decision, the people of Westeros don't have the ability to say, oh, we want a different king without totally, you know, engaging in revolution. And that's not a healthy functioning government to have.
What we have basically is, and correct me if I'm wrong, what we have is a class-based judicial system, more or less. Because I think even under Chehiris's reforms, if you are small folk, you're basically fucked in every time you are faced with the justice system at large. Whenever someone accuses you of something and you need to stand before a lord, you're in trouble. But on the other hand, and you you just mentioned this when it comes to arbitration, basically, if you are a lord, the justice system functions in an entirely different way for you, because the Westerosi system seems, to me at least, being set up more mostly to arbitrate conflict between lords. And it is not so much geared towards solving conflicts between, quote-unquote, normal people, more or less. So I think the Westerosi justice system works totally different depending on whether you're a noble or not. And, of course, it's also very heavily gendered. Funnily enough, there is little evidence in the text about it being racially charged, you know, it doesn't really come up, but the two major things that we have, the two major, slopes, more or less, in the system, are noble versus non-noble and men versus women in the system. Would you agree with that?
I would. I think that's right. I mean, so we saw examples of the Westerosi justice system with the small folk in A Game of Thrones, when you had the small folk who came to King's Landing to complain about Gregor Clegane raising their villages and putting people to the sword. And so you have to do if you're a small folk and you want justice for one thing or another. You have to go to appeal to the lord. In this case, they came to the king, and Ned Stark was sitting as hand of the king and essentially adjudicated this dispute. So it's not that you have no rights, but you have to appeal to have essentially your vassal lord or whoever it is argue for you. Like, basically, you have to convince them that an injury to me as a small folk is an injury to you as a lord. And that's a big ask. Conversely, as you point out, if you're a knight or a noble, you have all of these rights. You have a right, for example, to trial by combat, which is not, you know, necessarily a great right to have in sort of modern civil procedure, but it is a right that is not afforded to the small folk, as far as I'm aware. Moreover, you have the right to seek an audience between the king or the lord or whoever it is to mediate your disputes. So that is absolutely true. There is a notion of patriarchy that or the fact of the patriarchy in Westeros certainly pervades everything, including the justice system. We see that with Cersei. We see that with Margaery. We see that with there are other examples where women are, their concerns are dismissed, and that's certainly, as you point out, a slope within the Westerosi justice system.
One thing that I just realized that's also a problem, as you just said, you know, getting justice. In Westeros, even if you quote-unquote get justice, this doesn't, as a small folk at least, gets you anything, you know? Think of the people of Shira who are getting justice from Eddard Stark within this system in A Game of Thrones. I mean, this is more or less the best outcome they can hope for. But it is not like they are getting recompense or anything. The best outcome for them is that somebody dies, basically, for whatever they did to them. But this doesn't give them back their crops or their livestock. It doesn't help them with compensation money for workforce lost or whatever. You know, if you are a widow because your husband was slain by raiders and those raiders are hanged, that's great, but you are still without a husband and more or less destined for poverty because you are missing the workforce and you cannot sustain whatever farm you have, right? And the Westerosi justice system does nothing for those people. It's again a different kind when it comes to the nobles, because when they have grievances with each other, there is usually recompensation involved. You know, the land conflicts are obviously always ending with someone getting the land, and if you are accused of, for example, slaying the small folk, the quote-unquote owner of the small folk, will the other lord, will receive blood money of some kind, but never the people themselves. So this is also something where I can see where the class bias is coming through extremely strongly.
Absolutely. And it's also important to note that this is how it works in its best days. So this is how it works when everyone agrees who the king is. But when everyone doesn't, then you have almost total anarchy. So, you know, you see this at basically after Robert dies. You see people who are trying to enforce laws or talk about laws. Stannis is obviously a very, you know, fancies himself as the legal candidate, if you will, for the Iron Throne. But at the same time, he has to understand that he can make all the edicts he wants, but if people don't follow him, if people don't recognize that he is the king, and there are certainly lots of people that don't, then his laws mean jack shit. It means nothing. So in that situation where you have, you see it in the Riverlands all throughout A Clash of Kings and basically out throughout the rest of the series, where these people, you know, are getting absolutely massacred on a regular basis, and they don't really have anyone to turn to because they can't turn to the Lannisters because the Lannisters are doing it and they're the kings, but they can't turn to anybody else because it's not like there's an agreement amongst people as to who is the sovereign, the actual person who holds power and to enforce the law. So there's just nothing. And it, you see that over and over again in all of the, you know, the various chapters that you get and all of the various texts about what that lack of power structure ends up doing to the small folk specifically. I mean, everybody suffers, but the small folk suffer worst.
So what we would basically need is the king to nominate supreme courts of some kind, you know, to have people, because his day only has 24 hours. So he can never, ever, under no circumstances, serve as the ultimate arbiter in all those cases that would need it. So what he would need is a court system, but that doesn't exist, right?
That's right. It does. There's no evidence of any sort of court system. The best that you have is you have this sort of feudal aspect of the right of pit and gallows, which the lords all have and all retain. That's one of the things that Aegon, when he conquered, he allowed all of the lords to retain the right of pit and gallows. And so as far as I can tell, the right of pit and gallows is basically a dispute system or a dispute resolution system, theoretically, where if you have a dispute or if somebody breaks a law in a particular lord or in the area that a lord controls, then you go to the lord and the lord makes his decision and that's what it is. And that's not a great system at all, of course, because obviously some lords are good, some lords are bad. A lord might have a grudge against a particular person, but you don't have what you know, sort of modern democracies or modern states have, which is a separate judicial branch to handle those disputes. So you don't have that.
Now I want to branch off the discussion a little bit, because we now have two separate strains that we need to talk about further. The one thing that you already spoiled basically is we need to talk about the king and his function within the system, or I think that's what you were getting at when we're talking about the arbitration. And on the other hand, if your case, whatever it is, doesn't go as far, so you are not going to King's Landing to court, you are not getting a hearing, basically, then the Lord has to decide, as you just said. And again, I would like also to find out a little bit more about the foundation that a Lord is actually putting his judgment on. Because you said, rightly so, that you can have bad lords and you can have good lords, and that a lot of what you get out of a decision is based on that. But even the good lords are basing their decision on something, and usually it's tradition and precedent. So where does this all come from, and how does it hamper even the best intentioned judges in this kind of society?
So as far as I'm aware, where the right came from is that it existed in some way. My hunch is that it existed in some way as an outgrowth of the sort of hundred kingdoms that existed before, you know, the first men in the Andals, thousands and thousands of years ago, that the right of pit and gallows came out of that. That's my hunch. And it's just because that was essentially a system of 100 kings. You know, it's pretty similar to 100 different lords in a particular area. And so if you're going to give up your kingship, at least, you know, allow me to retain this right of this right to control my own lands, basically. You know, a man's home is his castle, all that sort of thing, the castle doctrine. So that's the idea, I think. And that's my hunch as to where it came from. The limits of it are, I think, you know, pretty interesting. So if you go to The Sworn Sword, which is my favorite of the Duncan Egg novellas, it talks about how, you know, Eustace Osgray, you know, is talking about Rohan Weber. And we all like Rohan Weber. I like Rohan Weber, I think. She's great. But she notes that when she's talking to Dunk, she says, the king's law grants me the power of pit and gallows. And then Egg answers, on your own lands. The king's law gives lords the power of pit and gallows on their own lands. That's what Egg insisted. So basically, Egg is saying, well, she has the right of pit and gallows on her own lands, but Eustace has the right of pit and gallows on his lands. Now, we also kind of like Eustace. And so, but the problem that you just talked about is demonstrated by this issue, right? Like, so you have two lords in adjoining lands who, you know, are generally good people. You can make arguments on one side or the other, but they're looking at a particular issue in two completely different ways. And so you don't have sort of a unified decision as to who is right and who is wrong. What you have is two lords who are going to then have a dispute with each other. And so maybe then they take that dispute up higher and higher, but you see the problem with that is that there isn't this unified rule of law that we've been talking about, even with this right of pit and gallop.
And also, if you would kick this thing higher and higher on the list, you know, the next step would basically be the Lord Paramount, in this case, I think the Tyrells, and then up to the king. One problem that you have as the claimant or the interested party, basically, is that the stakes are rising all the time, because you never know what the outcome of any of such trial basically would be. So if Weber and Sir Eustace would bring this case before the Tyrells or even the Targaryens, which is basically the threat that Egg is wielding, you know, like we're jumping all those rungs on the ladder and we're just going directly to my father, bam 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 bam, yeah, you know, You just don't know what will happen. This case could easily spiral out of control completely, and what started with a slit nose of some peasant could, by virtue of being a point of contention between those two people, take on a life of its own and be potentially threatening the whole existence of one of these lords or both. Basically, I mean, you see this on Joffrey's court, for example, where these two guys come with their land dispute, and he makes them fight to the death. Suddenly, your whole legal issue escalated in ways you would never have thought before. So bringing a case higher up is actually dangerous in this system, as it is not in our current system. I mean, if I bring a case before the Supreme Court, be it of the United States or of Germany, I know that they will just issue a verdict on my case. They will not suddenly say, oh, and by the way, you are enslaved, you lose your wife and your house, and good day to you, sir. This just won't happen, but it can happen in Westeros. So where does this come from? You know, why can cases escalate like that?
I think it's just a function of the feudal society that Westeros is in. And, you know, you have in, like you said, in sort of common law systems like we have in the United States or in Britain, or civil law systems like you have in Germany or in many European countries, you have levels of review of your case. But you certainly have a problem where in Westeros, those levels become more and more dangerous, more and more. There are additional implications that you might not want to pursue. And that also, you know, makes it so people don't pursue those particular grievances. You don't have an effectual dispute resolution process.
So who has an interest that we don't have this effective resolution process? Because you said the system makes it so that you don't want to actually use it, which is an interesting feature in any system. Right. And usually this is a very conservative thought, you know, make government as ineffective and difficult to use as possible to basically foster any other solution possibility before. So where is the impetus for anyone in the system to defer mostly and preferably to any other institution before you actually use the justice system at hand?
I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head that there is an inherent problem or a conservative issue with access, about access to government. You found that if you look back at history, that happened with most monarchical systems. That's why, that is one of the big reasons why, for example, in England, the Lords rebelled during the 1200s and created Magna Carta, was that they felt like they were being shut out of the system. And so Magna Carta is thought of worldwide as the first instance of rule of law, because it was a king agreeing to limit his own powers in some way. We look back in the way that he agreed to limit those powers, and nowadays we think that, like, that's still not enough. But you don't really see that in Westeros really at all. I think that the only evidence of that might be Jaehaerys giving the people the right to choose his heir in 101 AC. That's the only time I can think of a king willingly saying, okay, I'm going to be bound by certain things. And I will be bound by this decision. So I think anytime you have a system where there is not access to it, and there's not a monarch or a sovereign who's willing to limit his or her own power, you're going to have this exact problem that we've been talking about.
I think this is the moment where we can get a little bit more specific about case studies, basically. Where you can see this, for example, very heavily in the story, I think, is with Daenerys Targaryen, because she has to make quite a lot of these fundamental decisions, because she's a revolutionary in the East. You know, she is completely eviscerating an old order, and the only thing that she ever institutionalizes is her word, basically. So the things that she is adjudicating in the court of Meereen, for example, or even on the march, there is a plethora of stuff, you know, from a weaver's dispute of compensation for slaves over to high treason. There is nothing that is in any way beneath the decision capabilities of a Daenerys Targaryen, and whether or not your case comes before her is basically random. We can see how she decides who is getting a hearing in these endless court sessions, and usually it can't be everyone. So whether or not you get a hearing in the first place is is incredibly unclear. Then we have what I just mentioned, the uncertainty. You know, there comes this guy who demands compensation for his former slave setting up this competition shop of his, and he's imagining that he will get competition money, and instead he is fined like hell. And I mean, yes, this is definitely something that she should do, but it is inherently problematic if you are getting into court with the express thing of trying to get compensation for something that you feel that was lost from you, and then it is completely turned around, and suddenly you are the accused, and you have to pay these fines, and now comes the kicker, based on law that Daenerys makes up on the spot. And this happens all the time in these great, let me say it, adjudicating sessions that we get over the series. Again, Daenerys is just a big example of it, but we can also see it with Eddard Stark. We can see it with Tyrion when he is Hand of the King. We can see it to a much lesser degree with Cersei. We can see it a little bit with Stannis, although he usually quotes law in some capacity. I guess we'll have to make a side discussion for Stannis. But we definitely have this problem that Daenerys especially is making up laws on the fly, and every decision that she makes based on her current mood and her very personal understanding of justice, you know, what's fair, what is right, is then a precedent binding her and binding all of her successors and all of the lower courts, basically, at the same time. Because if you are a Myrinese, whatever they have to adjudicate justice if Daenerys isn't available, will look at the decision that she made, and the next time when a baker demands compensation, they will look to the Weaver case and go, this is what she would have wanted, I guess. You know, and this is also inherently and deeply problematic, and it is not in any way stable.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, the concept of precedent and how it's applied throughout Westeros is the topic for a probably, you know, 12-hour podcast that we could go through, and whether or not there is even precedent. You know, I think that I go back and forth as to whether or not there is a concept of precedent, because it's a weighty legal discussion. But precedent means essentially, okay, if a judge, whoever the judge is, makes a decision on one case, all cases afterwards have to be made the same way. And that's a feature of common law systems that doesn't always exist in civil law systems, or in quite the same way, but it's a feature in common law systems. And it can be problematic in its own way, because no two cases are ever the same. It's very, very rare where you have two cases that are ever the same. And maybe when Daenerys, you know, has that Baker case that you're talking about, maybe there is something more sympathetic about the Baker that might come through, and she might just be feeling a different way on a particular day and make a different decision. But the fact that she's not restrained in any way, she could make a totally different decision, but the fact that she has the ability to make a totally different decision makes everything really unstable, and makes that dispute resolution process very unstable, and could cause all sorts of problems. We see it cause all sorts of problems specifically in Meereen, but also, as you said, in Westeros, it happens all the time.
I think this is the moment where we need to talk a little bit about why they have this right in the first place. And a lot of it has to do with religion, basically. Because why does a lord in our own history or in Westeros and Essos have the ability and the right and the privilege and the duty, however you want to phrase it, to adjudicate at court anyway, because he or she is put in their position by the gods or God or whatever divine institution you have. So all those decisions that are made are, in theory or in the legitimizing legend that people tell themselves, basically, is not a arbitrary as thing happening on the whims of the ruler who may just have had a bad egg for breakfast, but rather it is the will of the gods that finds its earthly counterpart, basically, here in whatever the lord or lady is decreeing. So what do you think in Westeros, how much is the view that people have about any verdict that is made by lords and kings influenced by their religious beliefs? So if, for example, Joffrey is making this land ruling of the knights who have to fight themselves to death, how much is this seen as just the cruelties of a boy, and how much is it also seen as a legitimate ruling by the gods because they put him there in the first place?
Yeah, you're talking about the divine right of kings, which is a concept that, you know, we in the world have struggled to fight against or to push back against for literally centuries. And it certainly exists in Westeros. You see, the first thing that Aegon did in order to be crowned was to go to Old Town, go to the Starry Sept, and basically agree to become a member of the Church of the Faith of the Seven, was anointed by the High Septon, and that's how he became really. That's where his crowning was. That's where, as they talk about in the histories, that's where his reign began. And so anything then that a subsequent king or queen does is sort of ratified by the gods, by the primary religion of Westeros. Now, it's not the only religion of Westeros, but it's the primary religion. And certainly you hear people talk about, well, oh, the, you know, Joffrey is the anointed one. He, you know, all of the kings are, they have to pay homage to the Seven. And really that's a way for kings, like especially in Westeros, to show that they are powerful through those gods, and it's a way. And I talked about this a lot on the Nauticast podcast that we mentioned earlier. It's a way to demonstrate this belief in power. The Nauticast podcast that we were on was about Varys's riddle, and I think anytime you talk about how do people in Westeros get power? You have to go back to Varys's riddle, or the answer to Varys's riddle, which is power resides where men believe it resides. Well, what are ways in which kings in Westeros can get people to believe that they have power? And one of the primary ways is to wrap yourselves in the trappings of power, wrap yourselves in religion, the faith that people have in these religious iconographies, and so therefore I'm going to subject myself to the laws of the gods, so you should believe in me and give me power. And that's basically how it works. You do, however, have you have people that push against that. Stannis is, I think, the primary example, but he's not the only one, where, you know, his claim to power or claim to the legal right to the throne is not necessarily, at least initially, it's not a religious one. He uses the lore as a way to bolster his claim, but it's primarily a legal one. He's saying, no, look, I'm king because I'm actually the rightful heir. And he's correct, of course, but that doesn't get him anywhere. Most people are like, yeah, so he needs this additional part, this, oh, and also these gods over here like me, and so, or this god over here likes me, so put me on the Iron Throne because I have the right, I have this divine right of kings. And there's a lot that can be said about the divine right of kings in sort of political philosophy, going back to, you know, Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and the natural rights philosophers that kind of push back on it, saying that it's not actually divine. It's actually about, you know, the people conveying that sovereignty among the king. But they do it both in ways like, you know, voting to ratify it or going to war for a particular king, and in praying and in saying, okay, well, the gods have chosen this guy, so I'm going to follow him. I'm going to follow whatever he says. So yeah, I mean, I think religion is totally caught up in this, and it's a really powerful way for kings to declare their power.
I'm not taking the bait for a moment, and I'm leaving the S word aside. Talking about different belief systems in this case is very interesting, because there are two religions in Westeros before, or let's say two and a half, before Stannis starts his whole conversion. We have the Faith of the Seven, and we have the Old Gods. And then, for example, you also have the Drowned God. But let's leave them aside for a moment as well. Because as far as I understand it, at least officially, the Iron Men have to follow the law of the Greenlands, basically, until Greyjoy's Rebellion, at least. So, as far as I understand it, in Westeros, the people do accept the laws as basically divine on the one hand, but also encompassing both very different faiths. I think this is a very weird thing that's going on. There is relatively little conflict between the different belief systems. They have this whole the man who passes the sentence should swing the sword thing going on. But this is only an aesthetic choice. It's not really a gigantic legal problem that you have, because someone derives his or her authority from the Old Gods instead of the Faith of the Seven. So wouldn't we expect different legal practices here? I think there's remarkably little pushback against Jaehaerys from the North, especially against his codification of religion. Or do I have to imagine that some Northern stuff in a kind of large compromise is brought into the legal systems of the South as well?
I think there has been. And I think that you have to look at, sort of the cultural aspect of Westeros as a whole, right? So people think generally that, the first men, the quote unquote first men, are all in the North and they're all followers of the Old Gods. Well, that's not really true. And like, it's in the same way that, people in Germany or people in France are not all French, right? Like they're made up of a bunch of people who came over or who came in at different times and blended with each other. And so the Southerners, the people in southern parts of Westeros, sure, they're quote of primarily Andal, but they're also first men as well. What I think happened, I don't know for sure, but my hunch is that when the Andals invaded, that there was a lot of, intermixing and intermarrying, and a lot of, one way in which I'm going to assimilate into this Westerosi culture is take some of these first men traditions, one of which I believe is the tradition of Guestrite. That's my hunch. Or that's my theory, is that Guestrite started as something that first men practiced, and then the Andals came over and adopted it. And so you have this sort of thing that's practiced all throughout Westeros, but it means more in the North. You also touched a little bit about on the rite of First Night, which was practiced apparently more in the North, or is practiced apparently more in the North, depending on who you talk to. But it was still practiced other places in Westeros. But you're absolutely right that I guess on one hand, I think that it doesn't make it's not a huge problem that there isn't a huge difference between the justice systems of the South and the North, even though they follow different gods, because I think that that's part of Westerosi culture, or the dispute resolution system, the sort of rite of pit and gallows, is part of Westerosi culture writ large. But I think you're absolutely right that there would be some more significant differences, or there should be some more significant differences in how that justice system is put into place, or how it's used to resolve disputes, more so than just what you pointed out, which was the he that passes the sentence should swing the sword. There should be, some differences in application there that we don't really see.
So does the cult of the Drowned God have any major differences here, or is this also mostly an aesthetic choice?
I, there isn't a whole lot that I've been able to find so far about the cult of the drowned god and how they resolve disputes. That's a good question. My hunch is that they are first men too, I think. That's my recollection, is that they are first men, although they don't consider themselves first men. And so they probably practiced some similar things, but I don't know. That's a good.
What comes up to me regarding the Ironborn is the biggest difference is this whole thrall thing and salt wives and rock wives that they have going on. This seems to be the major divergence there. Basically, it is slavery in all but name. I mean, they're sugarcoating it with, oh, their children are completely accepted, but that's obviously horseshit. So. This seems to be a divergence there, but as you just said, the Rite of the First Night also seems to be mostly a northern thing, and of course they had those human sacrifices way back when. So, but generally there's not a lot going on. So now, finally, to the S word. What does Stannis change? Two questions here. Is there any influence that we can see from the rites of R'hllor that are influencing the law? And when Stannis is constantly referencing, that's the second question, the law, basically, and that he uses this for his own legend quite a lot, you know, that he is this just guy, that he feels himself bound by the laws, that he's just a instrument of the law, you know, like an agent of it, until he goes more the R'hllor route later on. So how much is there to this?
I think it's mostly in the method of enforcing the law where it comes in. So Stannis, right, like Stannis is a legalist first, right? So he, I think, and I don't like to spend too much time in Stannis's head, but when you talk about the law in Westeros, you end up doing that anyway. But I think he believes first and foremost that he is the legal king. He is the rightful king because of the law. And then also there's this R'hllor stuff that helps him to do that. So we do see him, you know, sort of mete out justice in various ways. One of which obviously was executing Mant up at the wall. And, you know, he was executed because he, you know, was the king and he, you know, fought against the crown and he needed to be executed. Well, my hunch is that Stannis, whether or not he believed in R'hllor, would have executed Mance one way or the other, because, you know, taking arms against the realm is it's an offense punishable by death. Now, what's different is that, okay, well, now that you are a criminal, and you need to be punished, I'm going to hand you over to this, you know, witch who's going to burn you alive. Similar thing happened when Stannis was marching on Winterfell and he found the people, and I'm blanking on who their names were or who they were, but who were cannibals amongst his crew, right? He found out that they were, you know, eating other people. He declared that illegal, and so he executed them by burning them, or he passed a sentence saying that he would burn them. So I think that it plays into it more in like sort of the method of execution, but I think Stannis doesn't change what is illegal or what is not illegal based on religion. I think that in his mind, the law is codified and the law is set and rigid, and sure, R'hllor might, you know, get to a couple extra sacrifices here and there. But at the end of the day, they're dead. So what does he care?
Yeah, that makes quite a lot of sense. I think the wall is also a different political system as well, but also a legal system that stands on its own, basically, right? Because they, as an order, you don't have, as a Night's Watchman, the ability to appeal to the king, as far as I understand it. So the law on the wall ends with the Lord Commander, basically. But the Lord Commander also seems like a person who is much less free than a normal lord to issue decrees and verdicts, because it seems to me that the watch is functioning more formalized than the lords themselves. Would I be right in that? And can we basically make this into a general point about all the orders of Westeros, the faith and the citadel and all of that?
Well, I think we know the most about the Watch. So I think it's important to start there, and that's a really good point. And I want to hit on a couple of things. One, yes, you're absolutely right as far as I'm aware that once you're a member of the Night's Watch, it doesn't necessarily matter whether you're at the Wall or wherever you are. If you're a Night's Watchman, you shouldn't be touched. The law says you shouldn't be touched. And we know that from a Clash of Kings, Arya 2, which is where, you know, the gold cloak, you know, goes to, you know, arrest Gendry, and Euron says, no, you can't take him. The law says that you can't take him. And then, you know, the gold cloak pulls his sword, and Euron pulls out his own sword and says, you know, that's no law, or that's no law. It's just a sword. Happens, I got one too. And so you're absolutely right that like basically once you're in the Night's Watch, it's a totally different legal system. But what is different about the Night's Watch, and you mentioned it just a minute ago, you said that the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch doesn't have the same rights as, say, the king or another, sovereign, despite the fact that, you know, he was popularly elected. And the reason for that is because he is bound by the Night's Watch Oath, which I would argue functions as sort of a constitution for the Night's Watch. I was having a conversation with Maester Merry about that, and she pointed this out, that the Night's Watch Oath is sort of a constitution, and I agree with her 100% that the Lord Commander himself is bound by that oath. So that is what we were talking about earlier, where it's a sovereign, in this case the Lord Commander, who's agreeing to be bound by certain limitations, and those limitations are laid out within the oath, and that's how he's supposed to act. Now, they don't always act that way, of course, and there's plenty of examples of that, but that's how constitutional governments work, right? Like you have the rules that are written down on paper, preferably, and that's how everybody should follow it. And when it gets broken, then there's a correction for failing to follow those oaths. So yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Whether or not the same is true of the other sort of institutions in Westeros, like the Kingsguard or the Citadel, or my hunch is that yes, to a degree. I'm not sure it's quite as clean as the Night's Watch.
Yeah, that makes sense. I also really like this idea about a constitution. That is an interesting aspect. I mean, the Night's Watch is really set apart also by this meritocratic idea. As much as they fail in the actual execution, it still sets them apart from a society that is defined by birth and not by merit in that way. Do you see any other pre- or proto-constitutional elements in Westeros, or is this just only the Night's Watch and nothing else will get it?
Well, like I said earlier, I think that you want to talk about proto-constitutional elements. I think that it's an essay that I've been meaning to write for a while, whether or not the Great Councils constitute a social contract. So like basically, whether the Great Council of 101AC, which was Jaehaerys saying to all of the lords, hey, I don't want to make this decision as to who is going to be my heir. You guys make it for me. And that's a king giving up a right that he has. He could make the decision if he wants, and agreeing to be bound by it. And that's a proto-quasi-constitutional feature. And then you have other great councils throughout Westerosi history. My hunch is that in the future we're going to get at least one more great council. That's one proto-constitutional feature. I think, Jaehaerys also trying to write this compendium of laws is sort of proto-constitutional, although again, it doesn't necessarily limit the king's ability to change those laws as he sees fit. So there isn't a whole lot that I can see or that I'm thinking of right off the top of my head.
But I have a problem with the great councils, which is that their decisions don't seem to be all that binding. You know, you have the whole Dance of the Dragons now, starting basically because no one seems to be bound by the decision of the Great Council of whenever it was. And they're just saying, oh, well, I wasn't there personally, and so therefore I can ignore it, basically. And I mean, this works better with the Great Council that makes Aegon the unlikely king, but even then, his legitimacy is always a little bit tarred by it. So I'm very hesitant to give too much credence to the big council idea, you know?
I agree. And I have I have an essay on my blog about that very subject. And I argue essentially that the Great Council of 101 AC did not convey precedent because it was a legislative decision rather than a judicial one. And so there was no precedent that came out of it. And essentially, I argue, and my point is that, okay, in 101 AC, you had the lords all getting together, and they looked at a bunch of different things to determine whether Viserys, who came from the male line of Targaryens, or Laenor Velaryon, who came from the female line, should be king. And they looked at that, and that was one of the factors of, like, whether the person came from the male or female line was one of the factors. But another factor was that Viserys was a dragon rider and Laenor wasn't. And Viserys was older and Laenor was just a kid. And so there was a bunch of different factors that they looked at. And they eventually, you know, settled on Viserys, who then became the king. And then almost immediately he declared that Rhaenyra would be his heir, essentially overruling whatever decision had been made by the Great Council. So while I think it's quasi-constitutional and might arguably constitute a social contract, meaning like people agreeing to be bound by this person or to be ruled by this person, I agree with you wholeheartedly that in terms of precedent, I don't think that the Great Councils mean much or anything really. And I think that they're an ineffective way of creating a constitutional government, a long-lasting government. They're the best thing that Westeros has towards that end or towards those ends, but they're not great overall.
So what do you think? Where is this development going in the future, you know, for the Westerosi future? I don't think that we will be seeing a great legal reform in the original text, basically. But do you think what we will get is more a system that, or what will Westeros get, is more a system that also gives codified rights to the general population? Or would you think that the development, if there is any, in Westeros is more going in the way of the Holy Roman Empire, which means that you have a very strong and increasingly legalized system that only applies to basically the nobility of the different principalities, which more or less become independent in all but name from the central institution, in this case, the Iron Throne, and use this, let's call it a proto rule of law that only applies to themselves, a very convoluted collection of laws to arbitrate their own disputes.
Yeah, I hesitate to make a lot of pronouncements or theories about how things are going to work. My strong hunch is that you're right, that we're not going to have, I mean, it's, even if we get, say, good King Bran or good Queen Sansa or, you know, whoever else takes over, it's not going to be a situation where then that king says, you know what we need a, you know, a federal system with separation of powers and a legislature that's elected by the people and blah, blah, blah. We're not going to get that. But I do think that given that how many times or how much things like great councils are brought up throughout the text, that we're going to get at least one more great council. And I would also think it's likely that we're going to have a devolution of power away from the Iron Throne towards, you know, more the local, you know, sort of state type governments that, like, you know, I think that it's likely that the North will be independent, probably also the Iron Islands or Dorne or other places. And you are going to see some differences. We know that George is concerned about this. He's concerned about, what does it mean to be a good ruler over time? There's that quote that everybody mentions about what is Aegon's tax policy, but that's, so what is he, you know, that he's concerned about, assuming that, you know, King Bran is canon, which I think it is probably, you know, he's going to be concerned about what is King Bran's tax policy? What is King Bran's policy for, you know, people who fought for the Targaryens or for Young Griff or whoever it is? He's going to be concerned about that. So I think you're going to get something about that. We're not going to get sort of, oh, everybody lives happily ever after, and now we have a liberal democracy and everything is great. So I think we're going to get something in the middle, maybe a bittersweet legal ending as well.
Yeah, that makes quite a lot of sense. And it's also a very good ending point for our discussion. So let me pose one last question to you. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you think wouldn't merit mention right now that we need to have addressed?
You know, I don't know. There are so many different legal topics that are brought up by the text. Like I said, when I first started this, I thought I maybe would write a little bit here and there, and now there are endless subjects. I have a post up on the blog that I just published last month called Offer Acceptance, Bread and Salt, about the guest right contract and how it's very similar to a contract in the real world. That we could talk, you know, there's a lot that can be talked about there. There's a lot that can be talked about Varys's riddle and what that means for the end game. But overall, I think that, you know, the most important thing to take about it is that the question of sovereignty is such an important thing for the story, but it's also an important thing for political philosophy in general as to what it means to be sovereign and what it means to have the right to rule and to have people convey sovereignty to a ruler. And that's really, in my view, what the story is about, is what it really looks like when a bunch of different people believe in a bunch of different sovereigns, some of whom are good, some of whom are bad, some of whom are not the right person, even though they're a good person. And what it means to, you know, when all that comes to a head, what do people do? And I think that that's something that I'm really excited to find out going forward.
Yeah, that sounds all very interesting. I'm totally a sucker for all of these topics, you know, be it the political or military stuff or now the legal things. So if you didn't find this experience of podcasting with me totally unagreeable, I will certainly have you back at some point. And this is now also a question I want to, or a demand I want to put out on our listeners here. So if you think there is something that you want to have discussed, you know, from a legal standpoint on Westerosi things, or Essos, we didn't even cover Essos in this podcast. So if you think you have a topic that we need to discuss in the future, please put it in the comments, tell us, and I guess we will be back at it sooner than later, because I think there's still a lot of stuff that we need to talk about. So thank you for doing this.
Yeah, I would love to. Anytime, Stefan. It's an honor and a privilege to be invited. I would happy
warm
to talk
fuzzy
to you.
Feelings. Thank you very much. And please tell us again where we can find your stuff so that everyone has it at their fingertips right now.
Sure. You can find my essays at lawsoficeandfire.com or on Westeros Law on Twitter at Westeros Law, or Clint W on Twitter. I have a Reddit account, but I don't use it very much because Reddit is creepy. But that's about it.
I mean, that's quite a handful. So thank you again for coming on. I hope everyone enjoyed it. Check out his blog. Check out his Twitter. He always needs more followers. And until then, see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by our Patreons from the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. The topic of the podcast was influenced by the Patreons as well, so if you are interested in having a say on what the topic of the next Boiled Leather Audio Hour will be about, check out the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. And if you are not interested in that, but interested in all the bonus content that you are getting, from exclusive essays to the audio version of said essays to early access to special podcasts and theory sessions and all of that, you can also check out the Patreon at, you guessed it, patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. So hopefully I'm seeing you again soon on this very podcast, and until then, have a very nice day, a very nice week, and however long it is until the next episode arrives.